Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, the weekly libertarian podcast brought to you by the magazine that's been sick of national politics since way before it was cool. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Gamar Hatimatova, everyone.
Howdy.
Yeah. Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
That's right. May your seal be whatever. So it's been a big week for national news today, which is Monday morning as we tape this. It looks like the five-month Writers Guild strike here in Hollywood has come to a close, unblocking the audiovisual entertainment production business. Hooray. In Detroit, however, the United Auto Workers strike is intensifying, with President Joseph Robinette Biden II heading there to walk the picket line, and Republican presidential frontrunner Donald Trump opting to head there to speak with the strikers rather than participate in the second GOP presidential debate Wednesday at the Reagan Library in Los Angeles. Trump continues to dominate the primary race, with his national polling lead recently widening to 44 percentage points. That's a full Reggie Jackson over the free-falling runner-up Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, if that is his real name. Much more alarmingly for Democrats, the 45th president has of late been polling neck and neck with and occasionally ahead of the 46th, as Biden continues to do stuff that 80-something men tend to do, like walk around confused and butcher people's names and tell the same story twice within the same brief monologue. Given the likelihood of another Biden versus Trump stinker, Americans are getting about as enthusiastic about domestic politics as the Finnish people get about winter. Think about it. According to a big new Pew Research poll released last week, 63% of the population have little or no confidence at all in the future of the U.S. political system. Everything is fine.
So they're optimists. Well, at least,
yeah, exactly. I don't even know what
crazy
the others are thinking. At least Congress is doing its job. Who am I kidding? Punches self in throat. Republicans in the Republican-led House of Representatives last week repeatedly tripped on their own appendages, voting down various motions to even debate their own spending bills as the federal government careens toward yet another funding deadline at the end of this month, with House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, the so-called Bakersfield Comet, hanging on to power by a thread. Hardliner backbenchers led by Florida hair model Matt Gaetz wants to introduce and debate and vote on 11 separate spending bills in the next calendar week or else, a position that McCarthy ally Garrett Graves from Louisiana called a stupid strategy cooked up by arsonists. Peter, let's start there, since you're the one who sent me that quote via Slack. Spending bills allegedly originate in the House, if I am reading my constitution correctly, but over the past years and decades, are instead just kind of a bunch of last-minute continuing resolutions negotiated by House and Senate and White House leaders in a very small room, perhaps a telephone booth, and then submitted to an up or down vote, preferably by voice. McCarthy was supposed to change all that as the price for his excruciatingly narrow and serially voted election to the leadership role. So what happened to that promise? Where are we at in the state of play for budget negotiations on this fine Monday morning, Peter Suderman?
Does everyone here remember the end of last year when Congress had its annual Do Your Job Week and they passed a ginormous all the things spending bill months after the initial budget deadline? And then, not long after that, the beginning of this year, Republicans won control of the House with a pretty small majority. And one of the big promises that Kevin McCarthy had to make in order to get the speaker job for the House Republicans was, we won't do that again. And what we won't do that again was understood to mean was basically two things. Number one, we will pass all of the appropriations bills, the dozen or so spending bills that are called for it in the budget process laid out in the 1974 Congressional Budget and Impoundment Act, which also created the Congressional Budget Office. And number two, we won't spend all the dang money. Well, here we are. It's the end of September, and the formal annual deadline for passing all the appropriations bills is upon us. And once again, Congress has barely made any progress at all. There is no budget deal. No appropriations bills have been passed. And as a result, we are set for a government shutdown starting at the beginning of October, which you might notice is this coming weekend. So McCarthy has, in classic fashion, proposed a CR, continuing resolution, which is basically a deadline extension. It's, I thought the paper was due Tuesday, but could I turn it in next month instead? It's what Congress almost always uses around this time each year when the budget deal deadline comes due. But a small group of conservatives in the House, Matt Gaetz and others, have basically said, nope, we are not doing that, not again. And they want to take the time to pass the appropriations bills individually. They also want to see a top line spending number before they go down this road of approving one bill at a time. That's a total dollar figure for what they expect all of the appropriations bills to come to. And McCarthy has resisted that. So they don't, you know, their inclination is we're not going to vote for bill one when we can't see where this is going to leave us with the total at the very end. And so I think there are basically two ways to look at this. One is the policy argument. And the holdouts there have an awful lot right, at least where spending goes. Immigration is also a big part of this. And I think all of us would disagree with their push for a much more hardline immigration stance. But at least when it comes to spending and the appropriations process, the holdouts are broadly correct here. On the political argument, the mainline House Republicans and McCarthy types have a real point, though, I think, when they say that when shutdowns happen, the party that is seen to have caused the shutdown tends to lose. And it's not just that they tend to lose in the court of public opinion. It's also that they then end up basically having to do stuff with, say, in this case, with Democrats. And that means that that puts spending cut wins at risk. And so their argument is we will lose on the spending front if we don't keep the government open and we don't just do this ourselves with only Republican votes.
Catherine, you hate the government, so do you therefore love government shutdowns?
I would love to shut down the government, but I don't love government shutdowns, and that is an importantly different thing, tragically, since we seem to be really, really good at government shutdowns at this point. I am old enough to remember. I grew up in D.C., and I remember the 90s when government shutdowns were kind of real and before we had like essential workers really sorted out and also before everything was essential workers, including, I guess, our spending on Ukraine, which we're just going to keep doing. You know, and what was it, a couple of years ago, we also made it so that everyone who's furloughed is guaranteed their back pay. This creates a horrible dynamic where, like, everyone is very cheerful, actually, about a shutdown. Like, my daughter has a planned field trip to the National Zoo in a couple weeks, which maybe she won't get to go on.
Are they not going to pay the pandas?
They're not going to pay the pandas. They're giving the pandas back.
Yeah, those pandas are part of the Chinese Communist Party. I mean, aren't they the ones who brought TikTok over?
The Chi Com pandas are going back. But like she will maybe be affected by the shutdown, but nothing else will. So we've created just spectacularly stupid incentives. I personally want to put Congress into some executive coaching of some kind, like or maybe like. Like, you know, ADHD kids get coaching in executive function. Like, I don't actually know which thing they need, but like, they could just do this in advance. This is not a surprise. October 1st happens every year. And the idea that they are being taken by surprise again is beyond belief. They must like it this way. They've built the system so they can keep doing this. I guess we're going to do this forever.
Are you saying maybe we should have a functioning executive?
It's not the executive's fault in this case. It's Congress's fault.
Nick,
I think we need to start talking about stepdad jokes, which are like dad jokes, except by somebody who's not really part of the family. So it's even more annoying. Am I wrong there, Matt?
I will tell stepdad jokes till the end of my days, and you can't stop me, Nick. You're not the boss. You're not my real dad.
Speaking of stepdad jokes, Nick, I think I speak for the elder half of this podcast when I say enough of the pander bears in Washington, D.C.
Oh, God.
Wow. That's just a dad joke. Yeah. That's just a biological dad joke right there.
But that line gave Paul Tsongas cancer, Matt. So you are, you watch it. Don't say it three times. Otherwise, you're not making it to the next general election.
My kids, especially the 8-year-old, sort of like twist the knife by saying, you know, when reacting to a bad joke for me, like, Dad, stop it with the uncle jokes.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Ouch.
Just like relegating me to some other status. Anyways, Nick, you and I have been through even more government shutdowns than Catherine, mm-hmm. or at least, you know, we had our adult Zardos mankinis on during those times. I see here over in the Associated Press over here that this one would, quote, disrupt the lives of millions of Americans, end quote. Is that what happens, Nick?
Yeah. I mean, obviously that happened in 2013 and all the other times, and we really haven't, you know, come back from that. I want to recall the whole government shutdown rhetoric is god awful. And I believe it was in 2013 when Ted Cruz was talking about, we got, you know, who is the architect of the shutdown, but then was like, you know, we got to keep the national parks open, which tells you how serious most legislators are about this. But god damn it, Matt Gaetz, whatever his name is right. You know, this is unacceptable and it's got to stop. There's got to be real repercussions. The Republicans are likely to lose the presidential election anyway, especially if Donald Trump is president. This would be a good time for them to actually act on principle. And this is not even a partisan principle. This is just basic math and accounting. According to Pew, out of the last 49 fiscal years since the bill that Peter was reminding us was passed in 1974, 30 of the 49 budgets were not passed on time. This is insane, and it really has to stop. People like Justin Amash, you know, the former Republican, independent, and libertarian congressman, was all over Twitter this weekend talking about the need to pass the separate bills. That's a starting point. And the idea of saying, you know what, this is the total amount we're going to spend next year, and we're telegraphing ahead of time, that would be fantastic. It is really, really important that we get to a point where there is basic, you know, just kind of competence in government. And again, this is beyond partisanship. I agree, I think, with what Peter was getting at, which is that these shutdowns are not good for limited government because they foreground the incompetency of government, which then does not get repaid by people evacuating the desire for the call for government spending. It ends up bumping up, which is what we've been seeing over the past at least 20 years.
It's actually even more specific than that in this case, which is that the argument, just to flesh it out very briefly, is that if Kevin McCarthy cannot pass the set of spending bills or some sort of mega spending bill, whatever it is, with only Republican votes, right? And remember, they have a very slim majority in the House, then they will have to go to Democrats to get it passed. And Democrats will extract a concession, and that concession will be costly, specifically costly in terms of money, that the top line dollar figure will be much higher if he has to use Democratic votes in order to get this passed. And so on the politics, I don't think that is a crazy or unreasonable argument. At the same time, the folks who are holding out for less spending overall and for a regular order appropriations process that they were promised. First of all, that was the promise. Second of all, that's what Congress should have been doing every year for the past 20 something years, and they haven't been.
Who is that financial guru where you like get all your money in cash and you put it in envelopes?
Dave Ramsey.
Like, I want to put Congress on the Dave Ramsey plan. I want them to like...
To do a debt snowball?
I want them to do a debt snowball to pay off the debt, starting with the highest interest rate, right? Like, that's how you're supposed to do it. Or maybe they could start with, like...
I think it's actually starting with the smallest dollar figure, because then you've paid that off, you then put that towards the next smallest dollar figure, right? And it snowballs until eventually all the money is going towards the one big thing.
They should do it in order of, like, dangerous geopolitical or, like, geopolitical exposure, like whoever's holding the debt. But I just want Congress to sit there with a giant pile of cash and divvy it out into envelopes, like on the floor.
That's what the appropriations process is.
I know.
That's literally what it is. It's 12 envelopes. How much are we going to spend?
They should do it with physical paper money so that America can understand. And more importantly, so that those idiots in Congress can understand.
You know, Catherine mentioned towards the end of her answer earlier about the Pentagon and the Pentagon announcing that it doesn't really matter for them, because even though all defense spending is discretionary spending, they're like, we're going to keep funding Ukraine. That is also an amazing statement by the deep state. Aren't they supposed to kind of keep it on the down low? And, you know, the fact that Biden didn't say anything about that, or I didn't even really hear Republicans talk about that. This is, you know, this is true deep dysfunction. And it's it's really going to be hard to, you know, to change this. But we need to, and at some point there needs to be somebody who's willing to take a stand. And for God's sake, you know, if it's Matt Gaetz, I don't know what that says about the American experiment, but, you know, God bless him on this.
I think we can all agree that it's time to defund Butterstick.
Here's the quote in question about the Ukraine funding, which came Thursday from Department of Defense spokesperson Chris Sherwood. This is like hours after Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky was in Washington, passing around the rattling the tin cup. He said, "Operation Atlantic Resolve is an accepted activity under a government lapse in appropriations." That's what he said.
I hate it here.
That's an amazing thing. Catherine.
Also, just a terrible name for that operation, Atlantic Resolve. That, I mean, that sounds like a Glade air freshener.
I think I have a candle.
You don't even think of the Ukraine.
Like
Where's
that.
The Ukraine? You know?
It should just be all be something about jackhammers. Operation Jackhammer. Yeah,
they used to all be called like Operation Screaming Eagle and things like that. Yeah. And then I think we got our comeuppance on those. So now we're trying to have a little bit more chill.
Yeah, and I guess freedom has been kind of sullied, right? Enduring freedom, future freedom.
Operation Resolve Pet Fresh.
I would like that.
It should all be outlaw country singers, like Operation Christofferson.
That would be pretty good, yeah.
Catherine, I don't know where that came from. Speaking of Donald Trump, were we? He tweeted out or truth socialed on himself again, and I will quote it to you and see what you think about our former and future president. The Republican, and like if it's loud, that means it's all caps. The Republicans lost big on debt ceiling, got nothing, and now are worried that they will be blamed for the budget shutdown. Wrong. Whoever is president, I can't do it. Whoever is president will be blamed. In this case, crooked as hell, Joe Biden. Our country is being systematically destroyed by the radical left, Marxists, fascists, and thugs, the Democrats. Unless you get everything, shut it down. Close the border, stop the weaponization of justice, and end election interference. We must have honest elections. So, Catherine, and I'm sorry that I couldn't figure out a register to do the capitalization, but words, not the full all caps, but I think you get the general idea. So, Catherine, everything is fine, .gif?
Yeah, I mean, that was Donald Trump's entire platform, right? Like that, if we're looking for like a platform statement, if we're looking for like what is the Republican Party up to in 2023, that Truth Social post is all of it. That was absolutely everything. And that is to say, it was a lot of actually just election strategy, just kind of like horse racy politics stuff. Like that's conventional wisdom. You can hear that on CNN any day. Oh, the party whose president is in power gets blamed for the shutdown. Maybe. But the mixing in of the debt ceiling, the standard budget process, border security, election security, just in one big mishmash, that's what we're going to get. And, you know, the fact that the debates haven't been that much of a word stew is only thanks to the fact that Trump hasn't been at them. But once we get to the general, that's what it's all going to sound like.
I do remember the shutdown in 2013 that happened the same day that the Obamacare exchanges went online, except they weren't online. They were completely broken. And that shutdown was intended to stop and defund Obamacare. And what it ended up doing was distracting from the fact that Obamacare was a disaster that didn't work. Republicans lost their policy goals by shutting down the government and throwing a fit about Obamacare when they should have been focusing on the real and actual problems with the law and with the operation of the exchanges.
And it also, and we'll close with this, so don't you talk back to me, Nick Gillespie. It also, that 2013 shutdown, it was a government shutdown, which aren't really popular. Debt ceiling negotiations and brinksmanship on that are the only one of these tools in the toolbox that ever poll particularly well. So what that government shutdown did, which was gratuitous and achieved nothing, is solidify in the minds both of voters, but more importantly with Republican leadership in Washington, specifically Mitch McConnell, but also Paul Ryan, that they shouldn't do that anymore. And that helped weaken the resolve that had been pretty good for about 3 years of Republicans in Washington to hold the line on spending. So that was a big problem there. All right. So let's move on to the auto workers strike. On Friday, President Biden announced that he would be going to Detroit this Tuesday. That's tomorrow as we record this, to, quote, join the picket line and stand in solidarity with the men and women of UAW as they fight for a fair share of the value they helped create. It's time for a win-win agreement that keeps American auto manufacturing thriving with well-paid UAW jobs, end quote. That scale-thumbing stunt from the self-described most pro-union president in American history was concocted after Donald Trump had already announced that he would be speaking to strikers during the GOP debate at the Reagan Library on Wednesday, urging them to reject federal mandates to produce electric vehicles. The Trump campaign has created an ad for the Michigan market saying, all they've ever wanted is to compete fairly worldwide and get their fair share of the American dream. Donald Trump calls them great Americans and has always had their backs. And speaking of Ronald Reagan, presidential candidate Tim Scott, senator from South Carolina, invoked the Gipper when he said that striking auto workers should be fired. Catherine, what is the federal government's, the executive branch's, the president's proper role in this or any private sector strike?
Oh, no, I mean, really, it really is none. And I know that we're so like that the federal government at this point is so wildly entangled with the automakers that it's hard to even see where one ends and the other begins. But if I was president, I would mind my damn business. I would support my colleagues in Congress while they work on some budget bills, and I would take a nap every day, and I would not be on the picket line, which is not an appropriate place for presidents.
Peter, is it possible to have this not be the government's business when we're talking about government motors here?
Well, I think it's inherently awkward for the Biden administration in particular, since one of the concerns the unions have is that Biden has been pushing electric vehicle construction. And not just pushing, I mean subsidizing, I mean signing laws and passing things in Congress, or you know, sort of signing things that Congress has passed under his urging. Electric vehicle construction that could put auto union employees out of work. And so one of the concerns here is that these companies are rushing ahead with electric vehicles that the Biden administration has said, hey, that's a great idea. We're going to give you a bunch of money or tax breaks or things that are effectively like money to go ahead and do that and just push forward with EVs because we think that's great for the environment. And the UAW is like, okay, but our jobs. And it's a little bit complicated for a supposed union man like Biden.
Nick, what does President Gillespie say on his speech in front of auto workers, and at what minute mark would you reference either the Declaration of Independence or Pop-Tarts?
Well, President Gillespie would first begin the speech by pardoning Edward Snowden, Julian Assange, Ross Ulbricht, yes, and Pete Rose.
Wow.
Because, and the reason why I say that, Pete Rose, of course, is not guilty of anything that relates to politics. But mm-hmm. as long as I'm overreaching and telling the fucking United Auto Workers what to do, I might as well weigh in and tell the Baseball Hall of Fame to get off their duffs and you know, put Charlie Hustle in the hall, but only as a Philadelphia Philly. And that way everybody's annoyed, right? Or maybe an Expo.
It's a Montreal.
Yeah.
An Expo, yeah. Yeah, if you're going to go for that it.
Because he might be the first Expo, you know, as an Expo in the hall or whatever. But no, this... you know, it's for me, the most important thing about this is that it shows, you know, how presidential politics is playing out. What Trump is doing, you know, and this is something Reagan had done in the 1980s, is that he is appealing to, you know, what used to be called blue collar Democrats or something like that, that became Reagan Republicans. One of the most interesting things about the 2024 election is going to be to see how much the old coalition of Democratic Party interest groups, including groups like the UAW, really start to split and splinter away from Democratic candidates. And, you know, obviously Tim Scott is not going for the UAW vote. There's also a bunch of car company, you know, car manufacturing plants and whatnot in South Carolina that he's, you know, he's kind of looking towards. But this is a genuinely interesting phenomenon to see the beginning of the end of the old coalitions that have been around forever. And Matt, as you might recall, in our book, The Declaration of Independence, we talked about the splintering of these groups. I mean, the UAW as it exists now is not what it was in the 70s or 80s or even the 90s, and it's screwing its younger, poorer members in order to pay off the Cadillac benefit plans of you know, older members who are either retired or about to retire. The whole world is shifting, and the idea that you would have the leading Democratic and the leading Republican presidential candidate going and pitching to you auto workers is really kind of fascinating.
Since Nick brings up political phenomenons, we should also just talk a little bit about the way that unionized factory jobs play this quasi-mythical role in our politics, especially right now, even though there are just very, very few of them actually left in the country, right? But you've got Union Joe in the White House and so much of the Republican Party, especially the younger sort of up-and-coming parts of the Republican Party, J.D. Vance and such, trying to take the mantle of the working class and turn the Republican Party into something even more of a working class party. But the fact is that no president, no politician is going to bring back old-school factory jobs or the old-school factory jobs economy as we had it in the 1950s or 60s. And some policies might make the decline a little slower. I think that is a possibility. But those policies would do so largely by imposing costs on the rest of America, making things more expensive and less available and less abundant. Like, we would just have less stuff. And that's the way that you keep those factory jobs in the Midwest.
All right. We're going to get to our listener email of the week here in a moment. But first, a reminder that this episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Friends, you ever get those Instagram ads fed to you about like how to do the best exercises while you're just still sitting in your chair or whatnot? So much of what falls under the category of self-improvement in this country involves working out various bits of your body so that you like or at least can tolerate what stares back at you in the mirror every morning. But what's the most important part of your body? You know the answer. It's your damned brain. Be honest with yourself. Are you working out that part of your bag of bones, the very operating system from which all else flows? This is where BetterHelp Online Therapy comes in. BetterHelp is an easy-to-use, super flexible, entirely online therapy service that has helped many thousands of people get their brains in better shape. All you have to do is fill out a quick questionnaire, get matched with a therapist, and if you don't like the first one, you can just swap them out for a second. Let therapy improve your mental and emotional functioning with BetterHelp. Just visit BetterHelp.com/roundtable right now to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/roundtable. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. Okay, reminder to please email your short queries to roundtable@reason.com. Got to roll the R's. This comes from Adrian Engelberth, who's totally a listener and not at all a Las Vegas entertainer from the 1980s. He writes, hello to all.
Why not
question
both?
Why not both? After years of debt crisis and spending, hand-wringing, is the U.S. and A at a point where the only way reform will actually happen is when younger generations, Gen X, where Adrian hails from, millennials, Gen Z, I don't know, it wasn't funny, can outvote the older generations, boomers and older. Gen X was never large enough in population to stop the olds from continuing mandatory spending. Second follow-up question would be whether millennials and Gen Z voters will even want to side with Gen Xers so to pull off mandatory entitlement reform. Nick, you enjoy generational war and gross generalizations, the likes of which curdle Jesse Walker's milk. What say you?
You know, first off, I just want to point out that this letter is such a Gen X document where it's like, you know, we have all the answers, but, you know, the coach never puts us in and we can't start our own team. Like, what the... You know, come on, what a baby to be complaining about, oh, we never were large enough to stop the olds from continuing mandatory spending. Having said that, you know, I think I mentioned this when I was talking about Burning Man either last week or last year. I have no idea where I am. I think I may be at the UAW strike, but I'm not sure. But, you know, the Gen X sensibility is a powerful one that blends idealism and kind of irony. And that's really what we need now. I worry, unfortunately, that as Gen X ages, it is not as interested in getting rid of Social Security and Medicare the way that it used to be in the 90s when it was really, you know, at its full-throated best, where, yeah, and Matt, you'll remember this, you probably participated in these when you weren't pretending to be Ben Affleck, you know, for pay, really, for journalistic expertise. You're like Nellie Bly. You acted as Ben Affleck for a day. That's like going to insane asylums in 18th or 19th, early, late 19th century, insane but asylums. No, when you look at Gen X now, I mean, they used to talk about how there were more people who believed in UFOs than believed that they would ever get anything from Social Security. And the lesson there was to let me out, just let me go, either with the amount I put in or not. When you look at polling now by age, people in their 50s, suspiciously, they're more and more worried about whether or not Social Security is going to be around, but they're not calling for its abolition. They're calling for its continuation. So I worry that Gen X is getting old in mind, if not in body, Matt Welch. So,
Peter, Gen X might be dithering, but if it dithers much longer, we're going to get to the come to Jesus moments, are we not, with certainly Social Security related, like time schedule, because we're going to get a haircut soon, right?
Man, as much as I really want to believe in like the generational hero version of the story in which the youngs all come together to defeat the olds and triumph in a story of good governments and like heroic and noble intentions, it's not going to happen that way. It's going to happen when we run out of money, and that's going to happen pretty soon.
What's pretty soon?
Pretty soon, Medicare, the big trust fund in Medicare is going to be insolvent by the end of the decade, maybe a little bit before that date keeps shifting. Similarly,
wait a second. So we're like in 2023.
Uh-huh.
So we're talking about within the next 6 or 7 years,
yes.
Say you.
And so at one point, it had actually been as soon as 2026. It's been pushed back a little bit just to because of some kind of budget shenanigans. Similarly with Social Security, mid to early 2030s, Social Security will not be able to pay all of its bills. That doesn't mean that Social Security will simply stop, but it does mean that unless something changes, and I would expect something to change, maybe not in the direction that all four of us would hope, but unless something changes, Social Security will not be able to pay all of its bills. It will send out either smaller checks or some people just won't get them while some people continue to get their checks.
Catherine, what say you to the listener's question about what are we going to do to stop Nick Gillespie from stealing all of our money?
Oh, it's mine. I paid into it. It's retirement, Matt.
Lockbox, something, something.
It's mine.
The oldest Gen Xer will become eligible for Social Security in 2027. That's bad news for Gen X being part of the Reform Coalition because, I absolutely, you know, people used to say all the time, like, I'm never going to see that money. That money is gone. And that type of kind of despair was productive in the conversation about what we were going to do. Unfortunately, those Gen Xers can see their cash money on the horizon, and I guarantee you they are rethinking in real time whether or not maybe Social Security, exactly as it is currently constituted, is in fact a great idea, and they're just going to get what they want to get and run.
Matt, become a prisoner of generational conscience. Start the campaign now and get your leading edge Gen Xers to refuse to participate in Medicare and Social Security. Say, no, forget it. We're out.
I like
we'll,
that.
We'll write letters for you in jail. You know, we'll visit you every once in a while.
I remember when that was more of a discourse among the libertarians of like, yeah. You know, do you have to refuse your government check? How come we don't talk about that anymore?
Yeah, especially
you know,
as it's
about
Matt.
It. Are my daughters, who I don't talk enough about on this podcast, apparently. But when talking about, you know, my prospective 15-year-olds, she's, I think, 15 already, but her prospective work, that out of every $100, you know, she got to pay in 8 cents or $8, I'm sorry, and the government, whatever. You know what I'm talking about. Come on, man, the thing.
$2.
Right, she going to give you her money.
You know how you get her to get on board with Total Revolution and say, and that $8, most of it's going to go to me. Matt Welch, your dad.
Yeah, I did mention that. And she was not thrilled with that concept at all. So yeah, that's how you do it. Coach your kids because you're useless. All right, we've got, speaking of useless, another one of those debate thingies coming up on Wednesday nights. Last time around, despite Donald Trump's counter-programming with Tucker Carlson on Twitter, a pretty darn large audience tuned in to watch the also-rans duke it out. Did the debate move the needle on polling? Well, in the 1 month since, Trump is up 2.5 percentage points in national polls. Nikki Haley is also up 2 points. Ron DeSantis is down 1.5 points. Mike Pence is down 1 point. And that's about it. If I was a betting man looking at these numbers, I would wager that we will not see Donald Trump on the primary debate stage ever in this cycle, because why would he? Catherine, you're a lady. What's one candidate and or one thing you'll be interested in observing Wednesday, and why?
I did not totally hate Nikki Haley's performance in the last debate, and so I therefore assume that she will be kicking off the next debate by just saying, let's do all the wars and also ban all the abortions. Like, I don't know. I'm obviously deep in despair about the
entire...
Didn't
you like her abortion answer?
Her abortion answer was good.
Last time, as far as Republican abortion answers go?
Her abortion answer was good because it was a realist's answer. It was about how the other candidates should stop pretending that they can secure a federal abortion ban, and that instead, they should be realistic about what's happening in the states, which is correct.
If only she was a realist on foreign policy.
She's not a, the word realist has lost its meaning at this point. But I will be keeping an eye on Nikki Haley. If she manages to not make me want to shiv her in a second debate in a row, then I'm then going to become a Nikki Haley stan. I don't know. Like, that's where I am. Because all the rest of them seem pretty awful. I do also hope that Mike Pence chooses to use his valuable debate minutes some way other than randomly attacking Vivek Ramaswamy. I think that he could do better.
All I'm hearing is that once a neocon, always a neocon.
It's somewhere in there in my heart, my neocon roots.
And, I wish Nikki Haley would stop using Eye of the Tiger as a campaign song.
Because
she should be using Darling Nikki. Are you kidding? Woo. I would vote for her.
Fair enough.
I would vote for her.
Darling Nimrata.
And on this, I'll just jump in, Matt, and say the person I'm watching, of course, is Meatball Ron DeSantis. And I want, you know, he was so bad at the last debate, he might as well be wearing those big white mud boots.
That
he puts on whenever he's trying to secure the down low Republican vote in Southern Florida. He is currently he is just without grip. He can't get any traction. He's like a cartoon character, you know, running in a mud splatter. And the big development was Trump, who is wisely ignoring, you know, these debates, as you pointed out, but he released an ad on Truth Social, which we'll link to, where it's to a song called Whoop a Man's Ass, and it is making fun of Ron DeSantis. It's as good as the one where the Ron DeSantis commercial where a Trump-backed person ran an ad where Ron DeSantis is eating, or Ron DeSantis figure is eating pudding with his fingers. DeSantis should give up, I think, and focus on either being senator or actually doing something, you know, more powerful for Florida other than trying to stop immigration there.
His polling numbers, national polling numbers, were at around 30% from December to March. Then they went to around 20% from April to July. They are currently at around 13%. Peter, you're from Florida. What the hell with Ron DeSantis?
Yeah, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has just not made a clear case for himself here. He has positioned himself as, and I think this is kind of all one word, Trump, but with some experience, but actually Trump is very good and we all like it.
There's a German word for that.
Yeah,
right.
Mm-hmm. I don't know what it is, but it's that. And while you can understand
Trump
why he
Freud
has largely declined to take on Trump or criticize him directly, it means that he's not making a distinctive argument for himself. And that is a real problem when his mainline argument about his biggest challenger is, hey, that guy would be pretty good.
So the person I'll be watching, as usual, is Vivek Ramaswamy.
Vivek.
Mostly so I can continue mispronouncing his name. But also because as the kind of Trump Jr. Outsider in this primary, and the guy who just like hogged the stage last time very successfully, he has been... he has been doing this interesting, very kind of like open strategy of saying, on the one hand, he's like Ronald Reagan's dream come true, like super American immigrant success story, et cetera. He's, you know, in his memoirs, he always talks about being so inspired and turned to conservatism by Ronald Reagan. And on the other, the 1980s just called and brought your Reagan party back or whatever. He's always attacking Mike Pence for and others for rehashing the same kind of tired 1980s GOP tropes. So how to do that while you're at the Reagan Library is going to be the neat trick that I'm looking forward to watching. I presume that what he'll do is that he will emphasize Reagan's kind of unorthodox background prior to becoming governor of California when he was a New Deal Democrat at some point, and also his outsider insurgent challenge against Gerald Ford in 1976. We'll see. It should be entertaining at the least, and at the most, it'll probably come with a bunch of just horrifyingly bad policy, which Vivek is very talented.
Maybe he's going to say the voting age should now be 55. He's going to get Sammy Hagar to come out and be his appointed spokesperson.
It's a Sammy Hagar weekend every weekend.
He and RFK Jr. are going to arm wrestle for the LP nomination.
Oh, I hate to say it, but RFK Jr. I think would crush Vivek.
In an arm wrestling contest? Vivek is in better shape than you think.
Push-ups? No, I don't think so. You know, if he was, we would have seen it. You know,
I have seen it in
person.
He's
fully clothed in the gym. RFK Jr. is stripping down. You know?
If we haven't seen our politicians actively doing push-ups in public on a debate stage, that they must have noodle arms. Like, I don't know that that's
Chris Christie.
Quite the
Vivek
impasse we're at.
He's already played tennis in the buff. He's shown us what he looks like. It's a little bit slimmer than RFK, fewer steroids involved, so-called steroids.
I'm just looking forward to presidential squat form discourse.
Yeah. The official Hoover ball competition. If you've ever seen,
you know what that means? That means we're going to get Tulsi Gabbard back. Remember when she was supposed to workout videos?
Oh my God. She was like jumping on top of Volkswagens from a standstill.
Like, box jumps. She is like big CrossFit energy, right?
Did she ever go away? Is my question.
Never. Not from our hearts.
Speaking of people who will never go away, on Friday, Senator Bobby Menendez, the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee since, the 1920s? And a longtime known scuzzbucket for most of his career in public service, was indicted on 3 federal counts of taking hundreds of thousands of dollars in bribes, including bars of gold bullion in the
pockets.
With his pockets. Normally, I would go to Nick first on all things New Jersey, but a late-breaking Slack message from my boss said, please come to me for the Menendez segment. Catherine, what gives?
Yeah, so I was not really paying attention to this, and then this morning I caught up on it, and like 7/8 of the way down the AP write-up, I learned this, that among the allegations against Menendez are not only like passing information to the Egyptian government and all kinds of stuff. He is also he allegedly pressured the Ag Department to stop opposing a monopoly that Cairo had awarded to a businessman's firm to handle the certification of all halal meat exported from the U.S. to Egypt. So this is it's like kebab bribery. Like that. Like we're. We're in a situation where this man is somehow just clanking around with pockets full of gold bars because of the exclusive halal meat provision from the U.S. to Egypt. What? This is how politics should be. This is what I want from my politics. I want us to be fighting about this. I want the budget to be set. I want everything to just be operating as described in the U.S. Constitution, except sometimes we have meat scandals. Is that so much to ask?
Nick, what the hell is wrong with New Jersey?
New Jersey has a great tradition of corrupt senators. Harrison Williams, who was at the center of the AB scam scandal that was in the movie American Hustle, which I highly recommend. Bob Menendez follows in that. We were talking last week about the change in the Senate dress code to allow John Fetterman to, basically wear a Snuggie to work. I really think we should be going the other way. And, senators should be forced to wear kind of like speed skating suits with no pockets. And that way, the Menendez problem is solved. Like, he's not carrying pockets, envelopes of cash or gold bars anywhere on his body.
In schools like that have like security problems where that you can only have a backpack that's clear plastic.
That's right. Yeah. And you can like put a puppy and your notebooks in there and that's it. Right.
Yes.
Menendez is part and parcel of a New Jersey, kind of climate of old corruption, bad business deals, et cetera. He comes out of the Union City machine, which he helped create. The most annoying thing about him in many ways, besides his very existence, is that he is constantly saying these attacks are attempts to take down a high-level Latino Jersey politics. And he's Cuban-American. And that is such a foul invocation of racism in a state that has, as many Cuban Americans, basically percentage-wise, as like any other state. I mean, it comes close to Florida. And for him to play that card is kind of an admission of guilt at this point in his career. I mean, he's 1,000 years old. He's a three-term senator. And to be doing that kind of crap on his second major federal indictment is just really beneath contempt.
Peter, you're from, you live in D.C. You're from Florida, but you live in D.C. Menendez being a just total, we can't say scumbag anymore, Catherine. What was the final ruling on the word scumbag?
Well, we put it on our cover.
But there was subsequent discourse that maybe actually scumbag predates the now retro definition that I talked about before. So I don't know anymore. I'm now scumbag.
We'll keep a scumbag. We're free minds, free markets.
TJ Hooker would rail against scuzz balls on network TV in the 80s. So, maybe scuzz balls.
So his, Menendez's scuzz ballery has been absolutely well known for decades. How does that kind of continue to perpetuate without someone losing his power?
I often disagree with progressives, but I think it was Matt Iglesias who tweeted something along the lines of, what this case shows us is that you have to address the roots of crime by giving people good jobs and health care. And like, if they don't have that, then, we can expect them to get into bad stuff. And that's obviously what's happening here with a senator with a $200,000 a year paycheck and federally provided benefits. No, I think Nick is really right to raise the discrimination angle. It's so amusing. There's this line in the New York Times write-up. He presented himself as a victim of overzealous prosecutors. Hey, we're sympathetic there, and said that he believed he'd been repeatedly targeted in federal investigations because he's Latino. I don't think that's quite right, but it is obviously discrimination against gold bugs. He's hedging against inflation. He's worried about the Fed. And while I'm not a gold bug in Biden's America, who can blame him?
He's also a big fan of sex work. So maybe he's really the libertarian,
Mm-hmm. Him and Hunter Biden. Man of the year reason. all right, let's go to our end of podcast, what we have all been consuming in the cultural arena of life. Catherine, do you want to lead us off?
Sure. I decided to attempt to become a better and more cultured person. So I tried reading some poetry this weekend. I don't know. So here, I read the New York Times Magazine had this excellent portrait of Shane McCrae, who is a poet. He was kidnapped by his maternal grandparents as a child from his father. Really, really good profile. A really excellent profile spurred by his memoir that he just published, which is called Pulling the Chariot of the Sun. We started this podcast with some You're Not My Real Dad jokes, and a lot of his poetry is basically attempts to work out who is, in fact, his real dad. It might be God. But I have always been one of these people that's like, I don't like people who say they don't like poetry, but I also don't like poetry. And so I should try to rectify that. This guy's poems are pretty good. I mean, I know I'm late to the game, but Shane McCrae, I read in particular, you can just go look in Poetry Magazine. They have always like a few sample works from various poets. And I particularly enjoyed a series, the Hastily Assembled Angel series. I don't know. It's poetry. It's super, super structured and then broken into little bits. And it was good. I don't know. Shane McCrae, try reading some poetry. If you, like me, are an asshole who says, I don't like poetry, but recognizes that that makes you an asshole.
Kathy, just to, you know, since we talked about the etymology of scumbag, the etymology of asshole, is that a reference to any kind of
I wouldn't know, Matt.
Speaking of assholes, Nick, what did you consume?
Thank you, Matt. And I, if I may, just to put in a good word for McDonald's and Joan Kroc, Catherine mentioned Poetry Magazine online, a phenomenal resource. And Joan Kroc, the widow of Ray Kroc of McDonald's fame, funded that forever and ever. It's almost as good as Wikipedia in a way, except that it's not crowdfunded, but it's phenomenal. But I want to call attention to a great website and particularly Instagram feed called Vintage Annals Archive, which is run by a photographer named Rich Wexler, who's based in Philadelphia. It is just a compendium, a kind of amateur's compendium of all kinds of weird, odd stuff from the internet that you can just pull together. And he directs people to this. It's a series of photographs. When Pee Wee Herman died, he did a whole series of different, you know, kind of archives of, you know, Pee Wee Herman's work online that you can watch, et cetera. Matt, you'll enjoy this. And this gives a sense of how bizarre and wonderful and how, you know, I don't think he can be retro online, but he calls back to the early days of the web in the 90s. He's got a whole long kind of podcast interview with Paul Williams, the singer, songwriter, actor who played an orangutan in a couple of later Planet of the Apes movies. And it's just like a phenomenally weird figure in American culture. And he's got this amazing treasure trove of that, as well as photo essays about, you know, kind of like Latino girls in the late 50s, or Puerto Rican girls, to paraphrase Mick Jagger, in the 50s and 60s in New York and the culture that they imbibed in. I highly recommend Vintage Annals Archive by Rich Wexler, both the website and especially the Instagram feed. It's one of the reasons why the internet exists and is a beautiful thing. And he also has a podcast, which is also fascinating. He's approached Brian Doherty to talk about his Dirty Pictures book, A History of Underground Comics. That's the kind of stuff that you find at Vintage Annals Archive. It is a wonderful, wonderful resource that will make somebody somewhere every day just feel much better about the world.
That's great. And always put in a good word for Paul Williams as a songwriter. Go jumping down that rabbit hole. Peter, what did you consume?
I saw A Clockwork Orange on the big screen at the Alamo Drafthouse. It is as great as ever. So if you're not familiar, A Clockwork Orange is Stanley Kubrick's dystopian sci-fi film about a violent young man who gets sent to prison, then ends up in a government reform program that's basically mind control. It's behavioral conditioning, where it becomes painful for him to contemplate violence at all. It is a blackly funny, incredibly bleak mind trip of a movie with so many meanly amusing just little jokes about the stubborn awfulness of human nature and existence in general. There's this great bit where the main character, Alex, played by Malcolm McDowell, is at a record store and he's standing between two young women who he has designs on, each of whom is carrying a popsicle. And he just looks at both of them and then turns to one and says, "A bit cold and pointless, isn't it, my lovely?" Which is basically Kubrick's outlook towards life in general. I've seen this movie many times before, but it's been a while since I watched it all the way through, and I'd forgotten how libertarian it is. It is very much a pox on all sides movie politically, with a right-wing politician and a left-wing dissident both trying to use Alex as a pawn for their political purposes. And also, it's just very much an investigation into the idea of free will, what it means to have freedom, if you can be both free and compelled to be good. And even more bluntly, it is a movie about how government programs fail. Specifically, they fail to change and reform people. And the reason they fail is because they are made of people. Great movie. You should watch it again if you have a chance.
I took a Kubrick class, film class at UC Santa Barbara under the great French film theoretician Michel Simon. And this is a serious humble brag because he's an awesome dude and one of the only people to ever really interview and get stuff out of Kubrick. As part of that, one of Kubrick's comments about the movie, and you should always take it with a grain of salt coming from him, but is that he wanted to make an anti-death penalty movie by showing someone that you absolutely should probably kill because he was terrible. He took it as a challenge, which I think is kind of an interesting thing to do.
I mean, on the politics of the movie, Kubrick was very clear that it was that he thought that it was making fun of both the left and the right politically. There's a quote, you know, where he talks about the minister, who's the government of the right wing government official who implements the anti-crime program. The minister, played by Anthony Sharp, is clearly a figure of the right. The writer, Patrick McGee, is a lunatic of the left. They differ only in their dogma. Their means and ends are hardly distinguishable. I mean, this is a line that could appear in Reason magazine.
I also want to note that Virginia's public school high school literature curriculum pairs Clockwork Orange
with
Ayn Rand. Like that, they're in the same unit, and it's kind of a miracle we didn't all come out libertarians.
I was going to add what's fascinating coda to all of this is that the novel version of Anthony Burgess's Clockwork Orange that was used by Kubrick was the American edition, which came out shortly after the Kennedy assassination, and as a result, lopped off one of the last chapters, or actually the last chapter.
Specifically, the 21st chapter.
Yeah. Right.
The idea where Alex sort of ends up being cured of his youthful violence, not by via a government program, but just by growing up. And the idea was, of course, that he turned 21, became a man. And like these things just sort of pass. And if you panic about them and try to exert build a government program around reforming these people, that will fail. What you need to do is have a little bit of patience and understand that this is human nature and this is how people work.
Yeah. Knowing this and telling this fact to people is a sub-variant of nerd of the same thing as knowing that Viggo Mortensen broke his toe when he kicked the helmet in Lord of the Rings and desperately wanting to tell people when it happens on screen.
In any case, Rolling Stone, I don't know, they may have taken it down, but in the 80s, they actually ran the final chapter with an introduction by Anthony Burgess. They may have taken it down now because, they seem to be anti all kinds of individual autonomy and free speech and things like that.
And art. Screw them. All right. Mm-hmm. Speaking of art and Rolling Stone music, My What Shoe is a box set that was released on Friday. Remix, remaster, and extra goodies of one of my very favorite records of all time, Tim by The Replacements, came out in 1985. Replacements were a thrashy punk band with a bleeding heart from Minneapolis. Many Gen Xers' absolute favorite, like a hot mess of a rock and roll band. And Tim, which is just fantastic and always has been, you've probably heard the song Swinging Party or Party Down the Line. Because it for some reason got into various remakes and television productions, but big anthemic songs like Bastards of the Young and whatnot. And so it's always been a huge favorite. And this remix of it, one of the criticisms of the record over time is that it sounds too 80s. Like it has the big splashy, horrible snare drum sound, too much reverb on everything. Just really for a hard rockin' band, it was not the greatest mix, even though it's a super great record. I have never heard in my life a remix of a record that I like, let alone love, that is so different and so changing and makes an already great album like three times as great. I don't have the vocabulary to talk about what a terrific mixed this is. You can get it on all of your streaming platforms. Don't have to buy the full box set, although I probably will. It's the Let It Bleed, they call it, Ed Stasium mix of Tim. And the great thing about it is that they didn't they didn't bring in little elements that had been recorded but that weren't used, right? Which a lot of people do in remixes, or in the case of the Double Fantasy remix, I think it's called like Double Fantasy Naked or something like that, of John Yoko. They, you know, took out entire like backing vocals and other things like that. That's not funny, Nick. There's nothing funny about that. They took the raw material, and they kept the raw material. They just took out the horrible, terrible sound glop that they put on it, and instead it just snaps. It's incredible.
May I ask you, because Ed Stasium, I believe, engineered it, Tommy Ramone produced it, and they have obviously worked together on the Ramones and a bunch of other projects and things like that. Does Stasium talk about the process, or why, who was putting the 80s glop on top of things?
It was Tommy Erdély.
The Hungarian-born drummer who kept the backbeat of the punk revolution, Matt Welch.
Yes. It's disputed, as is everything in the Replacements, because they were just the messiest, most awful, self-sabotaging band on the side of Big Star, who is their heroes. According to their lore, Tommy Ramone mixed it by using headphones, maybe like Walkman headphones or something. And just like he took the raw material and messed it up. Like the performances were there, but he glopped it up, and he shouldn't have done the mixing. He should have just done the producing and let Ed Stasium do the mixing in the first place, but for some reason didn't do it that way. That's the story. Tommy Ramone hotly disputed that all, and whatever, it's all fine.
May I ask Peter, because I know this is going to make Catherine have an early onset stroke or diabetes, but do you guys, I mean, on a certain level, I love to hear remixes because that's always interesting, but kind of don't we have to go with the document that was released that had the influence, that had the impact? Because Tim was not a small record when it came out in terms of alternative, what was then called alternative music.
This is a big discussion, but I basically think there's a real difference between a remix and a remaster, and remixes often totally change the song. They're changing the instrumentation. They're maybe only using a couple of the original tracks. And a remaster, a good remaster, just takes the original idea, makes it sound better. It's like removing all the little bits of blue glow around the X-Wings in the original Star Wars. I mean, when George Lucas released the THX-approved sort of updates of Star Wars in the 1990s, he added in a bunch of CG that was unnecessary and a bunch of scenes and shots that were kind of dumb. But he also fixed some of the flaws with the original effects work. And if that's what you're doing with a remastering, then I don't see any problem with it, especially since most people, even people who are not audiophiles today, have access to much higher quality music playback systems, whether it's even just cheap AirPods or something, Beats headphones. Music reproduction quality for most people, the equipment is just a lot better. And so that's going to reveal flaws in some of the old recordings, and fixing those doesn't seem to me to be a problem.
That question was actually discussed by the great rock critic Stephen Hayden, who writes particularly well about the Replacements and anything coming from the Midwest, where Stephen comes from. He interviewed Tommy Stinson, the bass player, who was 18 when Tim was released, and like 13 when the band started. And he asked him that question, like, is this the version of Tim now? And Tommy said, no, not at all. The first one is the one, even though he hated the way that sounded too, but that is just what exists as the piece of art in the world. They also do in this box set a remaster, which is different than the remix. So the remaster is the normal kind of remastering process and fixing the little flaws, but the remix is essentially kind of a different document of the same record. But for me, it is going to replace it. I'm going to use it because it sounds like the band that we knew was there. And it doesn't diminish at all my already fondness for all of these songs and these performances. It lays them more bare, and it's just terrific. All right, that's enough time talking about that Nick Gillespie. We are getting to the end where we say goodbye and thank you. But before we do all of that, we have a bunch of upcoming events, Nick, in New York City, at least two that I can think of. What do you want to tell people about the Reason Speakeasy and other types of things?
So this is Monday. On Tuesday, September 26th, we've got a great Reason Speakeasy, a live taping of the Reason Interview podcast in Midtown with Yasha Monk, who has a new book out called The Identity Trap, A Story of Ideas and Power in Our Time, which is a fantastic critique and analysis of identity politics, where it came from, why it's powerful, and how to combat and move past it into a more fertile kind of cultural discussion. In October 10th, we're going to be talking with Alexander Hudson, who has a book coming out about civility being underrated in politics. I'm going to try and reduce her to tears during that, because that seems to be wrong on its face, but that should be great. And then on October 11th, also in New York, we're going to be having a showing of Reason's Psychedelic Renaissance documentary that Zach Weissmuller directed. And we're going to have an after panel with Rick Doblin, the head of MAPS, who is the central figure in the document, and arguably the, you know, the Timothy Leary 2.0, who's bringing about a trippier, freer, less traumatic present in American life.
Awesome. All right. So go to reason.com/podcasts for all of our podcast work. Go just to reason.com for our work. And if you would like to encourage us to do more and better of it, please go to reason.com/donate. Give us money. Helps. All right. Thank you very much for listening. Have a safe political week in the United States. Wear a helmet if you need to, pith helmet, and we'll see you next week. Goodbye.
Oh,